Okay. Hi, I'm Roger Dannenberg from Carnegie Mellon, and most of my work, at least the stuff I am proud of, is work in computer music. And what I'm going to talk about today is mostly a language I've developed called Nyquist, which is based on Lisp. And so the title of the talk is Functional Programming for Signal Processing: There's More to Life Than Inner Loops. So computer music, I think, is a very interesting area for work in both language development and computer science in general. It's, as far as today's talk goes, computer music has very demanding computational requirements. This has historically been a big limitation, is just getting enough computing power to compute the kinds of signals that we want to compute. But music systems also have very high demands for expressivity. We want to build systems that composers can use. And composers don't sit down and write a set of formal specs and then get a big engineering team to implement them. Composers work usually by themselves. They don't really know what their final product is until they hear intermediate results. So there's always a lot of trial and error, rapid prototyping, experimentation, combining things in different ways. And so computer music has led to a lot of interesting language innovations. A lot of the early data flow, well, some of the early data flow work gives credit to music as an application area that actually inspired the some of the original work. In my work, I'll show you there's some, this Nyquist language has some temporal semantics that are fairly unique to computer music languages. There's also been a lot of work in visual programming for novice programmers that's widely used in computer music circles. So a lot of interesting stuff happens in this domain. So again, Nyquist is a functional programming language for sound synthesis and music composition. So, and in the talk today, what I'd like to do is first of all describe the kind of general kind of computation that we're doing with these music composition languages, sound synthesis languages, just so, because not everyone here has a computer music background, and I think you have to know sort of what this computation looks like before anything else I say will make sense. So then I'm, after introducing the model of computation, I'm going to describe how we do this in describe this in functional terms, and hopefully you'll agree that things look a lot cleaner and are a lot neater. But this will raise a lot of efficiency and implementation issues. So I'll talk about how we do efficient inner loops, and then I'll talk about how just the Lisp and functional approach actually leads to all sorts of other kinds of efficiency. And sort of as a teaser, what we end up with is a system that is not only more expressive and makes it very clean and straightforward to express a lot of complicated computation, but we end up computing faster in this Lisp-based system than sort of procedural imperative programs written only in C. So, model for computer music synthesis. So this is a vast simplification, but it sort of is here to give you an idea of the structure of the computation that we do. So what do we compute? Well, as you probably know, digital audio consists of sequences of samples. Each sample represents an amplitude at an instant in time, and we typically compute around 44,000 samples per second of amplitude, and then you run that through a D2A converter and you get sound. So how can we synthesize a signal like that? Well, the first example I'm going to give is, let's say that we just start off with a table that looks like this, that represents one period of a periodic waveform, so a tone. Okay, and then I've been told never put equations in talks, and so this is the equation, but I'll tell you what it does and not try to explain the equation. So intuitively, what we're doing is we're stepping through this table of samples by a fixed amount, and the step size translates to frequency. So the larger the step I take, the higher the frequency is going to be. And when I get to the edge of the table, I wrap around and grab another sample. And so I'm just constantly cycling through this at some offset and outputting the points, and we get something like this. Okay, and so that's for some step size, and if I use a shorter step size, I won't go through this signal as rapidly, and the frequency will go down, and we'll get something like... Okay, so that's part one. Now, that's a pretty boring sound, actually. So one thing we might want to do is multiply that sound by some other function of time that controls amplitude. We usually call this an amplitude envelope. And you could describe that function like this or with some other description. I mean, this is sort of the equational form. And then we can write this equation. If this was the signal, that tone that you heard, and this is the envelope, if we just take S of t times E of t, we get the resulting signal. And here's what that sounds like. So now you can hear it has sort of a soft onset and a long decay, and that's controlled by the envelope. If I put in a different envelope, this is an exponential decay, we get something like... So it's exactly the same oscillator going into it, but a different envelope. Okay, so... now I want to introduce the concept of unit generator. Since everything's a function of time, usually when we think about working with these signals, we just drop the time parameter because we don't really need it. And we can describe that computation we just did iconically. So we have an oscillator here, an envelope here. We put those through a multiplier. And these little units of signal processing are, for historical reasons, called unit generators. It's a really great term because, you know, we could call them objects or agents or, you know, something that is so overloaded. But the great thing about unit generators is nobody else likes that term for anything. So it's completely unambiguous, even though it's kind of non-intuitive. So, okay, so that's unit generators. So, now how do we actually organize computation and an implementation? Well, we have some state and an inner loop that computes each one of these unit generators, or runs each unit generator. And typically the way these sort of procedural imperative synthesis programs are organized is... you take a description of how these unit generators are patched together, you build up a structure, and you run the first unit generator. It outputs a block of samples, maybe 512 samples, or maybe just a handful of samples. And then you go to the next unit generator, it outputs a bunch of samples into another block. We run the multiply unit generator, and it takes these two blocks, multiplies the samples pairwise, and outputs a block. And when you're all done with this, you can send the final block out to the D2A converter or write it to a file. And then, so now you've computed either a handful or maybe 512 samples or something. And you iterate. You go back around and you run all these things again. Each one of these has, well, oscillator and envelope generators have to have some internal state, like to keep track of the phase, so that when you resume the oscillator, you pick up where you left off. Other things like multiply are stateless. That it doesn't really figure into the model so much, but just a technical detail. And so you can just iteratively run these things and output a stream of samples. Okay, so now let's think about this in more functional terms. First of all, these, what we usually call patches, or these sort of data flow diagrams, are... typically some kind of acyclic graph, and they translate very well to a set of nested expressions. So I can write this little tone generator that I've built as this Lisp expression, where we just say multiply the waveform with some parameters by envelope. An envelope might have some parameters too, but it doesn't in this simple example. So that's a very clean way of expressing things, much cleaner than you would typically see in some more procedural sort of system. And the problem with this, if you think about it, is what, you know, how do you actually implement this? The naive way to do it would be, well, you compute waveform, and that's going to generate a few hundred thousand samples, maybe. So you allocate this big table, and you return the array, and then you call envelope, and that's going to go off and generate another megabyte or so of data, and then we multiply these two arrays together. Maybe that's the MATLAB approach. So if you can do that, but it's going to take a lot of memory, a lot of allocation, lots of copies. It's going to be very slow. And if you do something realistic where you're computing maybe 20 minutes of music, and at every time point in music, that sample is the result of maybe hundreds of operators, you're going to be dealing with gigabytes or terabytes of data, and it's just not going to run efficiently. The way we solve this is basically through lazy evaluation. And so I want to describe, first of all, sort of abstract data type for sound or for signals that in Nyquist is called the sound data type. Just to give you an idea of sort of from the user's perspective, what are these objects that we're dealing with? So a sound data type is basically a function of time. It has a starting time, it has a termination time, and there's another thing I probably won't talk about called the logical stop time. And it's implemented as a sequence of samples, so there's a sample rate. There's also a scale factor that enables you to, without actually touching all the samples, scale the signal. So again, to the user, this is just a function of time. And this is the abstraction that that we want to deal with and deal with efficiently.
Is the sample rate changing in that diagram?
No.
Okay.
Sample rates are fixed on a per sound basis. Okay, I guess at some point I should throw in that. So Nyquist is built on XLISP, which some of you may know of or remember as a Lisp interpreter that's written in C, so it's very portable, very small, runs about as fast as any interpreted scripting type language. And the sound data type is going to be implemented in C, and this data type is actually very tightly integrated with the XLISP implementation. So the garbage collector knows about sound data types and so on. Okay, so this is the data structure that implements the sound data type. So this is kind of under the hood. Because we want to be able to evaluate these sounds lazily, incrementally, we, instead of allocating a big array for the whole sound, the sound is constructed of a sequence of sample blocks, or a list of sample blocks. And we access, because the structure is a little bit complicated, we access it through a reader object. So the anyone trying to get samples out of a sound doesn't really see the structure. You just interface to it through the reader object. And the reader object's job is to sort of march along, accessing these things sequentially. And when you get to a point where a sample block is missing, you call on a suspended sample stream generator, which is really essentially one of these unit generators, and it computes a block of samples that you then link in. So I have some more sort of pseudo animations here. So when we start with a sound, When we create a sound, it looks like this. No samples have been computed. We have a list that terminated by a unit generator. And when we try to read a sample, we'll come to the unit generator. It generates a sample block. We stick it here. And now we can access the samples. When we're done, we move on. And the because there are no references to the tail of this list, we can free up that list node in the sample block. And then if we need, as we read the next block of samples, we compute another block, and we just continue advancing through the list like this. So the other case that's kind of interesting is what happens if we have more than one reader reading this this sound type. For example, we might compute the sound and store it in a cache or assign it to a global variable or do something so that we can come along later and reread the samples. So we only want to compute it once, but possibly read it many times. So in that case, we start out the same as before. When we go on to compute the next block of samples, this second reader object is advancing through, forcing the computation, but because we have a reader object at the up at the head of the list, that these samples are retained. Okay, and then finally, here's a sort of putting everything together. This is what our oscillator multiplied by an envelope looks like at runtime. So here's the expression, multiply waveform by envelope. The whole expression is represented by this reader object. It's basically using this multiply unit generator to generate samples. This guy, in turn, has links to the waveform sound and the envelope sound. So when this guy demands a sample, the multiply will go out, demand samples from these guys. These sample blocks are computed. They're multiplied together to get this sample block. So if you remember going back to this slide, we were calling unit generators in sequence. They generate blocks. The blocks are combined, and we get output. And that's effectively, computationally, if you look at, you know, exactly where memory is being used and what computation is being done, it's actually the same thing is happening here. It's just that this is using a lazy evaluation and a sort of functional way of describing things, but you end up with the same computation. Yeah?
What determines the size of these sample blocks? Is that just a fixed unit?
In Nyquist, they have a fixed upper bound. They're about 1,000 samples each. And the reason for the sample blocks is you need... once you get into the inner loop and start computing samples, you want to compute more than one to amortize all the overhead of getting there in the first place. And so we sort of arbitrarily... Well, it's a compile time constant, but it's around 1,000 in Nyquist. So this gets you to the point where you're essentially doing the same thing as these efficient, quote, efficient imperative procedural implementations. But it's necessary now to actually write all these unit generators, and these unit generators are dealing with a lot more complex data structures and boundary conditions and things in the Nyquist implementation. And so it turns out to be something you really don't want to write a lot of by hand. And so to allow for efficient inner loops without coding a whole lot of stuff by hand, we use a declarative specification of unit generators. It looks like this. Basically, this is saying this is the product operation. So this is going to implement multiply. It has two sound arguments. There's some stuff about knowing, figuring out where the sound starts and where it ends. This says it's commutative with respect to these arguments, which allows for some optimization, or actually just makes the code more compact. It's linear with respect to S1 and S2, and which is another hint to the compiler and or code generator. And then finally, the real meat of the operation is here. This is essentially C code where output S1 and S2 stand for basically this signal at time t, the second argument at time t, and this is the output at time t. And so t is going to represent each sample time. And so it's up to the code generator to actually wrap loops around all of this and implement it. And here's just the very innermost loop that's generated from that previous specification. And you can see here's output got replaced by this expression. S1 got replaced by this expression. S2 got replaced by this expression. And then the loop got added. This is for those of you who know C, this is a very funny looking loop. This is actually the optimal way to write the loop for an RS6000 with the IBM compiler. It saves a couple of instructions if you do that as opposed to a for loop. And then there's, we actually have to execute this loop sometimes many times, and you know, every time we, the point I want to make is there's another couple hundred lines of code that surround this to get these registers loaded, to get all the pointers in the right place, and to do the right kind of iterations. Okay, so using these compiled inner loops, those inner loops are compiled and just statically linked with Nyquist, and using block sizes of about 1,000 samples to amortize all the extra memory runtime data structures, Nyquist becomes about as efficient as C code or these, you know, simpler procedural implementations. So then the interesting thing is now that we have this much more powerful data structure and we have Lisp to drive this whole thing, the language expressiveness can make Nyquist even much faster than just C code alone. So we actually typically get about another factor of 2 from other optimizations, and so that's what I want to talk about now. First of these is dealing with mixed sample rates. So things like that are usually called control signals, things like amplitude envelopes, vibrato control, frequency filter coefficients, are very important in music and actually entail a lot of specification and a lot of computation. Sometimes there's 10 times more control information being computed than actual audio information. And these control signals can be computed at very low sample rates, typically. So Nyquist supports mixed sample rates, and it does linear interpolation within the inner loops to at least by default. So these control signals are just upsampled at when you finally need them at the sample rate. So if you look at this and say, oh well, okay, great, we'll compute control signals at low sample rate, but now we're introducing a new operation, which is linear interpolation, and that's going to slow things down. And in a traditional system, it would. So the interpolation overhead, which is going to actually take a small number of samples and write out a big number of samples into a block somewhere, that would almost destroy a lot of the efficiency gains. But since we have these automatically generated inner loops, we can actually generate specialized code for every case. So we can have a multiply with one high sample rate input and one low sample rate input, and we can do all the interpolation inlined inside the inner loops, and so we don't. It doesn't actually cost us anything to do this interpolation. Another area is sample accuracy. So in many synthesis systems, time is quantized to to the boundaries of fixed length sample blocks. So these sample blocks that I showed you in the implementation actually sort of get tied into the control structure and timing and all kinds of things where it really shouldn't, they shouldn't be. And as a consequence, it's common to use very small block lengths to avoid time quantization and other artifacts that you don't want. But Nyquist uses variable length blocks, and so every block actually has a little header that says how many samples are in the block. And by doing that, it actually, it's sort of a nightmare for these inner loops because now they have all these weird boundary conditions. I've got one argument that's got an input block that goes to this time, and I've got another argument that goes to this time. So when I hit this boundary, I'm going to have to break out of the inner loop, force the suspension to compute another block, jump back into the inner loop. And so there are all these very tough boundary conditions. But again, we can use our code generator to automate all of that stuff and get it right. And so as a result of that, Nyquist normally is looking at very good-sized blocks, but everything is aligned to within a half of a sample period. Okay, another area where Nyquist and the flexibility of Nyquist and Lisp come in is in traditional synthesis languages, there's a hard barrier between what is called the score language and what's called the orchestra language. So the score language is basically a flat list saying at time t or with duration d, call upon, instantiate some synthesis algorithm like flute with these parameters. And then at some other time, make another instance of flute, and maybe we have an instance of sax down here. So that's the score. And then the orchestra is just the definitions of these collections of unit generators that actually do the signal processing. Okay, in Nyquist, there are some temporal semantics. So you actually can specify not only what sounds to compute, but when to compute them. And so that basically takes over the role of the score language. So it's all integrated. So we can say, for example, I want a sequence of this sound expression and this sound expression and this sound expression. And that makes a sequence of sounds. You can say, I want these sounds computed simultaneously. You can say, I want this sound offset by time t. And I want to stretch this expression by some stretch factor d. And so by combining all of these things, you can basically build up scores, combine things like in a musical score. So here's a, and you can do these at any level. You can do them sort of at the very top level, or you can embed these score-like behaviors inside instruments. So here's an example of an envelope where instead of writing some complicated bunch of conditionals inside to say, well, if I'm during the attack phase, I do this. If I'm in the sustain phase, I do that. I'll just write a score, basically, that says I'm going to compose my envelope to be an attack phase followed by a sustain phase followed by a release phase. And by doing that, the attack, if it's just a straight line or some exponential curve, then there's no conditionals in the innermost loop testing to see what phase I'm in. And those conditionals, break the pipelines, and they're really slow. So I had the experience of benchmarking some really trivial synthesis in conventional synthesis language called CMix. And I ran the same thing in Nyquist, and Nyquist was running several times faster. And I really had to scratch my head saying, how could CMix possibly be running that slow? Because it was all kind of hand-coded C. And I finally traced it down to the fact that in one of the innermost loops, the lowly envelope generator was spending an inordinate amount of time because of all these conditionals. So this is just a quick little picture of what sequence looks like in the Nyquist implementation. Seek actually generates is sort of a unit generator where you're taking, let's say, the attack and generating samples and then just basically linking the output samples from here into the output samples of the sequence. But then when you reach the end of attack, this suspension has a pointer to a Lisp closure, which is the sequence of the remainder of the sequence, and it will actually activate this closure and step through the sound.
Doesn't that involve a conditional? I mean, doesn't that hurt your pipe?
It does, but actually, the conditional is not in the inner loop anymore. The conditional. The inner loop just runs attack for at least a block at a time, and you only have to check on block boundaries what to do next. Okay, so Nyquist also takes great advantage of polymorphism or dynamic types. This is a low-pass filter of noise with, here we have a constant scalar value for a cutoff frequency. Here we have a sound or a signal with a time-varying cutoff frequency. And what happens in the implementation is these, somewhere deep down in the system, these actually give rise to independently generated, customized, optimized inner loops. You know, one where this 500 is just going to be in a register, and one where we're actually accessing samples to get a time-varying filter coefficient. I already described how sequence takes advantage of closures, and sequence itself is actually a Lisp macro. It would have been really difficult to implement all of this without Lisp macros to hide. Well, basically, we're using Lisp macros to build a new language, Nyquist, on top of XLisp. Another example of just sort of the expressiveness of Nyquist. There's a technique that lots of us like to use called granular synthesis, and I'll just play a sample. The way that is produced is we take a sound file of something that would sound much more conventional, and we're chopping it up into little grains. So you can think of this as related to wavelets and Gabor synthesis. But anyway, we're taking little tiny 10, 20, 30 millisecond samples of that sound, and we're sliding them. We're adding envelopes to smooth them out a little bit, and we're randomly sliding them around in time and randomly adjusting their pitch. And so granular synthesis is lots of fun, and one thing that's great about it is there's so many things you can do. You might say, hey, I would like to reverberate each grain individually and play them backwards or something. And what would that sound like? So there's no way that you could ever write, you know, the granular synthesis unit generator. You really have to give composers the ability to write their own and sort of modify the code and do anything they want to. And so if you have a conventional language where you don't have the ability to write scores and to manipulate sounds, then you end up with sort of a black box granular synthesis unit generator, and composers get whatever you write for them, and the details are hidden. But in Nyquist, you have the opportunity of going into the source code, manipulating things and sort of building the granular synthesizer you really want. Another idea, and this is actually used to implement granular synthesis, is this idea, concept I call here tail iteration. So imagine if you want to define a drum roll. Okay, so what's a drum roll? It's a drum stroke followed by a drum roll. So this is a recursive definition of drum rolls. And using seek, because of the way seek works and because of lazy evaluation, you can actually implement this. This doesn't cause stack overflow or doesn't, you know, use any significant amount of stack. This is actually how, you know, if you just replace this with grains followed by granular synthesis, you get a granular synthesizer. So to conclude, Nyquist is based on XLISP. We've added a new data type called a sound. It's completely integrated with the XLISP runtime system and garbage collector. Sound allows programmers to express sound computation using nested expressions. Lazy evaluation automatically reduces expression trees to an efficient, what I call the standard model of unit generators and buffers, so it has efficiency. That alone gives it efficiency comparable to more procedural imperative systems. And then you get another factor of two or so of efficiency, typically by automatically translating these optimized inner loops and applying expressive language constructs like these temporal semantics, allowing mixed sample rates, and so on. And so as a result, Nyquist is both highly expressive and highly efficient. And we have time for questions.
We have a few minutes.
Yeah.
Have you considered, for like linear envelopes, having just basically computing the step for each sample and in the inner loop just incrementing the current value?
That's exactly what happens.
That is okay.
Yeah. And there are also exponential envelopes where you just do repeated multiplication. Yeah.
How hard is it for you to teach musicians to use this sort of Lisp-based language?
I would say not too hard. I haven't actually taught a variety of different languages. My impression is Nyquist is much easier to learn than sort of the traditional languages like CMix and CSound that are text-based languages. I would not be surprised if it was harder to use in a lot of cases than the kind of visual programming systems like MaxMSP. Although I think students are much more able to build complicated sounds with programming Nyquist than these visual programming languages, just because of the expressiveness. Yeah.
Is there any real-time capability to control a sound once it gets going? Or if I've got like a slider and I want to play with the frequency and I want to have the sound go up and down, does that mean creating a new sound on the fly and starting that one off?
Yeah, it does.
The C stuff won't look, you can't write down into the C global state at all and have the...
Right, well that's, okay, so there's a whole lot of, that's a big question, but the basic answer, I guess I should say, this work kind of derives from a sort of paper design language called Arctic, which was intended to be a functional real-time control language. And one thing that happens, when you implement these data structures this way, they have the feature that you can actually look ahead in time. So, for example, if you're doing interpolation, you want to know what you're interpolating to. It's very common to not to read these things in time order. And, of course, with the buffers, you're always computing ahead of where you actually need to be, and then you stop. So time is very flexible. And the fact that these are all sort of side-effect-free functional programming means you can get away with not doing everything in lockstep in time. So when you want to bring in real-time control, hook up sliders and stuff, then you have a real problem of, first of all, just kind of dealing with time. And you can probably get away with that by adding some latency in. And I guess the next thing I want to do in this direction is you could define unit generators that are basically just slider values. So you have this unit generator called a slider, and it pops up a slider, and as you're computing, you can wiggle the slider, and it won't be low latency real time, but at least it'll be interactive, and so that much I think we can do. Haven't done it yet. Yeah.
XLISP has a continuation? No.
No.
So why you use XLISP? I know that. All the signal processor commercial version use the scheme because scheme has continuation. So if you use the continuation, all signal is processed at stream. No a memory. You don't need no memory.
Well, right. So that's...
Why don't you use...
So why don't I do that? Okay. So mainly, well, I guess the honest reason is is just historical reasons. This was started a long time ago, and machines at that time, I mean, my observation was that machines were sort of barely running Common Lisp. We had to have a pretty big, expensive workstation to run a bigger Lisp. Scheme, actually, I don't know. Well, anyway, I was familiar with XLisp, and I was looking for something very small because I was thinking of this project originally as being much more focused on the signal processing and the C data structures.
I strongly recommend to try to tackle Scheme.
Well, yeah, okay, so I could do that, but looking back on it now, this streams and continuations idea might be what you want to do if you want all these runtime structures actually being Lisp structures. And I'm not sure what that would do efficiency-wise. If you wanted to have a pure Lisp system and all these unit generators would actually be written in Lisp and be Lisp code, then Scheme or a... It would be easier. I don't think it would run as fast.
But XLisp has two namespaces, so I prefer XLisp.
So, okay.
Okay, I think we're going to have to take the flame war outside here.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.